Let me try and put across some of the aspects of this issue as I see them, as I've absorbed them. Some people who know more than I do. And then you're welcome to ask questions. If I'm able to, I'll answer. If not, so my friend will answer.
Thank you very much.
It's appropriate time of year to talk about this, because if anything lies in ruins right now, it's probably the emunah, the depth of emunah tzaddikah. We know that that's never really lying in ruins. It says, "Ani yishena v'libi er," that means the heart, the depth of the heart of the Jewish people, that's never really sleeping. But the point is that no one can deny that we're living in an age of tremendous attack on emunah. If you look at it explicitly, just what we can see outwardly, we know that if you trace Jewish history, although there are many who try to say that it's not true, but if you trace Jewish history carefully, you'll find that until very recently in Jewish history, until 150 years ago certainly, there was a level of emunah that was so flamingly alive in the Jewish people that millions of Jews were prepared to give their lives in torture, including many little children. The strength of emunah of families, including very young children, was almost out of sight. There were pockets here and there of such weakening, maybe, and even those are debatable. But whole communities, not especially at this time of year, throughout Jewish history, were not just done away with, but tortured lingeringly, painfully to death. And people, rather than even pretend to accept anything else, were prepared to go through that experience. That's a remarkable experience, remarkable history that we have. If you look in authentic annals of Jewish history, you'll find that happened, changed only recently. 100 years ago, 200 years ago, maybe, certainly not more than that we entered a phase where, as Abba Vigdamina puts it, for example, he says that if you look at every Jewish destruction that ever happened to us, it was always with a choice given. Never was there a destruction in Jewish history, or very seldom, when a choice wasn't given to the victims. That means, accept our religion, go against your own tradition, or we'll torture you. And the Jews chose correctly. The first time there was a destruction without a choice being given was in this generation. Why? Because we couldn't choose correctly anymore. We couldn't be relied on to choose correctly anymore. So we had to be in the kind of Shem Shemayim without the additional level of being able to do it, as it were, voluntarily with choice. Remarkable idea. So we see in Jewish history that there's no question we're dealing with a generation that's tremendously confused. And one of the last thing on the list for many Jews who remain somehow Jewish. There are many reasons. One of the reasons intrinsically is that Emunah is the most difficult thing. Emunah is not easy. Now, very often says that Emunah takes a lifetime to get anywhere. Emunah is not easy. Emunah means knowledge of Hashem's existence. It's not a kind of sort of bamboozled hypnotic belief. That's not Emunah. You might as well believe in anything if it's going to be at that level. Emunah means intrinsic knowledge of Hashem's existence, not actually experiencing it, even though it cannot be demonstrated or proved in a scientific or technological way the way some other things can. That's very hard to come by. It needs all the input you can give to a child from the very beginning to come up with any of that at the end of the day. So intrinsically, it's a very difficult thing to do. Ritualistic observance of Judaism is much easier. But feeling it in the heart and really knowing it, coming to everywhere you can say you really know this to be true, that's very difficult. Secondly, there are extrinsic problems. We live in a generation where emunah is certainly the last thing on the list. Where that's laughter, scoffed at, a knowledge of a higher existence, knowledge of transcendence. That's a generation now that explicitly teaches the opposite. You have to be very careful of that, even if you send your child to a school where there's Jewish input, like that. But if in the biology class they teach him that he's some sort of modified gorilla, and a few million years of accidental bumping to each other in the jungle, it's resulted in him, so that's very hard for a child like that to come up with some innate knowledge of his own transcendent existence. It's not just school. If you want to educate your family or yourself in any subject, I can tell you, as when I was at medical school, I was struck by the fact that you look even in anatomy textbooks, even the parts of the body are named on evolutionary basis. There's the neoencephalon, you know, the new part of the brain, the part of the brain that evolved more recently. There's the older part of the brain. Read books on mothering, you'll find. You'll see that the instinct of the child to nurse is because millions of years ago, there's nothing. There's not a book on psychology, on anatomy, on human behavior, there's not a book on anything that isn't based solidly on an absolute knowledge that evolution is true, not even close as a theory. And you, in the midst of this, you have to tell your children that all that's not true. It's a very difficult thing. It's a very difficult thing. If you live in an effective ghetto where you can control the education more closely, it's a little bit easier. But those are few and far between also. Unless you live in certain very tiny pockets of areas in America, maybe, or Giselle, maybe, but even there, The world's getting to a stage now where it's impossible to really isolate and insulate completely. The children have to be given the wherewithal to have that inner strength and also to be able to deal with the outside world effectively too, and not be weakened through that. Without making them negative individuals and critical about everything. It's a very, very difficult challenge. Let's see if we can try and work out together some of the points maybe that we should try and remember in dealing with children and trying to educate them more. The first and obvious thing that you have to know is that before you can educate a child, you have to educate yourself. There's no question about that. The problem is that that's almost as difficult. It may even be more difficult if you're starting at an age when you don't have a lot of it. If you're part of the culture, the phenomenon, as everybody should be, then you may have even a more difficult problem. On the one hand, you may have a lot of excitement that you generated for this new energy that you're spending in the world. On the other hand, you have to cope with a background that still has underpinnings in secular thinking. Some say that if you come from a film background, if you're trained that way all along, sometimes you have more problems in some way, because you may lack a certain excitement, a certain energy, a certain enthusiasm to move into these areas. Whatever it is, there's no question that the process is difficult. And we need to understand the figure of the moon to know what it is, and to know how to manifest it, and especially how to manifest it when children are watching. We're not going to go into discussion this morning about the whole background of the moon. You'll find 8 tapes in the library that we discussed just a little bit of the basic background, emotional, scientific, maybe rational, Kabbalistic, different aspects of the whole question of the moon. But let's just maybe understand that when we say emunah, what we mean is not, again, not some sort of decision that this is the way you're going to go. It's a working on oneself to come to feel and to know. In English, what we mean is that. That means an intrinsic inner bonding with the thing. So that this higher level of reality is actually part of your own being. We talk from the slightly different context. We talk from that's best defined as the ordeals of emunah. When we say on the emunah, we talk from means, basically, how does your emunah hold up when it's being tested? Emunah is, you know, what do you think about this? What do you feel? What do you know about this area? What are you able to give over to your child? It often means when things are not going so well, when your emunah is being stressed, and you've been put in the crucible of a test, of an insight on the emunah, then bitachon is how well your emunah stands up to that test. And of course, that's where children look most critically. That's where, those are the things that are blazed into a person's consciousness for the rest of his life. How did you stand up to a particularly difficult experience of emunah when the going was not easy? Some of the ways of teaching oneself emunah are the best ways of teaching children emunah. So, let me give you an example. Some of the elements of training emunah and habituating oneself to the pathways of emunah are, first of all, davening. That means when you pray, when you daven. So davening is a connection with a higher reality. You do it convincingly. I mean, if you daven effectively, and you daven with heart, and with feeling, and with all your inner being, and you look for the signs of the results of your davening, and you have confidence that results will be yielded. They aren't always the results you expect, maybe. Sometimes what you think is good for you is not good for you. That's another subject. But if you do that with heart, and your children see it, so you'll be teaching it to yourself and to your children. Davening is a wonderful tool. Well, if you're going to do it anyway, which you should be doing anyway in a family that's building these ideas. So the family should be intensely involved in davening. It should be an intrinsic core of what's happening. You should understand what davening is and be able to do it correctly. Not just some sort of outpouring of the heart. It's a direct conviction that things don't happen in the world unless you ask for them. There's no question about it. It's not even understood. Again, it's too big a subject for this morning to go into in detail. But if you do that with heart, you should daven with children see you. A Jewish woman, the first thing holds. Should daven, there's no question about it. Many hold it to life at least a few minutes ago. So you should daven effectively with tears. Why not? Why not? And it should do it where children can see. If it's the living, if it's sad means, there's no nature. It should be done where a child can see. You have to be careful that you're not going to be disturbed. You have to work it out at least part of the time. So a little girl will see her mother pouring her heart out in that way. No thing to keep secrets. There are many who analyze the South African Jewish thing and point out that one of the reasons that we weep in certain areas is because our parents are too private about them. You know that? In the Sfaradi world, for example, the mikveh, the whole area of mikveh has remained, even in many secular Sfaradi, has remained a strong element. And in Ashkenazi world, for example, here, in many South African Jewish women, it's a surprise to them to hear about mikveh. Why? Certainly their mothers did it or their grandmothers did it, but they were so secretive about it. They were so private about it, and with good reason, I'm not denying that the thing never got transmitted. Well, you make a bracha. Make a bracha with feeling. Not mumble it quietly to the child's mouth. On the contrary, the child will learn negative input from that. You make a bracha, you do it as an educational experience. You do it loudly, you do it with feeling, it's rattling up. Many families will see the parents demand that the children make loud, clear brought of the Baba. And that's obviously the child will take his cue from the way he sees what you do. The second major area of training Imuna, of teaching oneself Imuna, and teaching children Imuna, is to be able to feel the results. Try and understand this together. You see, to keep a child fed on an idea that he can't really experience, that's a very tall order. Very tall order for oneself. But if one can pick out where you see the thing operating, of course it's a more subtle thing. It's not like seeing technical, scientific, mechanical things operate. One has to have a more subtle appreciation for it. But if one sees the results of Imuna, you see what we call Ashgacha. Ashgacha practice, that means where Hashem actually relates, let's call it, interferes, manipulates, gets involved in your life. If you see that and feel it, again you won't find it easy to transmit to someone else. You're guessing this happened and you know it happened from a higher source, but you certainly can feel it yourself. That understanding of Ashgacha practice, being able to seek it out and feel it out, and one should do it explicitly, one should note the events that happen to us in terms of Ashgacha, and give them over to one's children, and show them and demonstrate them all the time. That is living in contact with Imuna. That's actually feeling Hashem speak to you. He doesn't speak to us as openly as he once did in terms of open record, but he certainly speaks to us in terms of Ashgacha. And so if you make a list, you make a story, you write in the Gula of the Inyanim, of the things that happen to you in terms of Ashgacha practice. You tell stories about it. You share it with your children. So you make it a lot for them, and you train your children to see it. But our pastors here from Gateshead, and Shabbos, he said a very beautiful thing. He said he heard from our brothers. This is the kind of thing to share at the table, maybe, Shabbos table with children. He said a very beautiful idea. He said that it says in Pasuk Masay, the second Pasuk, it says, Eilim Moitza Ohem, looks like Moshe Rabbeinu wrote, he wrote the travels of the Jewish people. He wrote, the way Pasuk says, he wrote what happened to the Jewish people in the 40 years of wandering according to their travels. That's what it says. He wrote down what happened to the Jewish people according to their travels. The end of the process reverses Moitzayim and Masayim, reverses the word. These are what happened to the, these are the troubles that happened according to the things that happened to the Jewish people. Now there's the word for the events that happened to us, and the troubles that led to those events are reversed in process. Now God needs to explain it, things this. This is the way to learn a possible story. He needs to explain it like this. And Moshe Rabbeinu writes the story, he writes it like a story, like you have to write. The story says that these are the events that happened according to the troubles, which means that the troubles were set to place and then this event occurred. But then the prophet reveals the errors to you. But you should know that the things only that the troubles only happened because that event had to take place. Because that event had to take place over there, so then Hashem erased it, that the cloud moved and had a move to that place. That means, and that prophet, that's amazing. That's the prophet that's teaching you Ashgacha, how to look at Ashgacha. The prophet tells you explicitly that the superficial view of the world, that what we call the Havamina. The whole training of Jewish thinking is to perceive, to be able to pierce through the Havamina. That's why we study Gemara that way, men. Men are very dense in this area, you should know. Women are the repositories of their Emunah. They don't need this experience of being able to punch through it that way all the time. Women are the natural. The Kabbalists say that Emes lies in the man's mind and Emunah. It says, Ihu Emes, the Ihi Emunah. The female quality of Emunah. That's what it says in Kabbalists. So what happens is that the prophet is telling you that there's a natural way of the world, you go to a certain place. When you get to that place, something happens. But the evidence behind it that you need, your woman needs this to understand, is that you have to understand you only went to that place because, you know, the cause and effect are reversed. Because that needed to happen in that place, the same causes that you should get there. So just to train yourself to see it that way. Once our Gifka had a girl from Cleveland to Baltimore. A wonderful, wonderful story. She's a people to your children. Now Gifka, great graduate of Yeshiva in Cleveland, he took a group of his Talmidim and they had to go from Cleveland to Baltimore to a chatten. So they flew off to wherever they had to catch their connection to Baltimore, and in this town where they were waiting for a flight. So Baltimore, the flight was late. So they waited and waited and waited, and finally they just realized that even if the plane came now, they'd be too late for the bus. So they decided to go home. So Halika, they got the sign, they go back to Cleveland now. But before they went back to Cleveland, they'll get to set in Tommy, they should have a minter, because they'll get back too late to have a minter. So they wanted to govern in a private area of the airport. They didn't want to govern in front of everybody. So they saw a janitor, person with a lot of keys on his belt, walking past. So they'll get to call him over and ask him, do you have a private place, maybe a room where you could take us to the government? So the man said, sure. He walked them to the airport and he found them a private room, and I've given his Talmidim and a minion, the government. At the end of the minion, the janitor walks over, the man was waiting by the door. And he said, maybe one of them could help him say Kaddish. So Kaddish, so they helped him stumble through the Kaddish, and when I've given heard that, he went up to the man after and he said to him, what exactly the story here? You say, Kaddish. The man said, Rabbi, my father died 7 days ago. Yes. And he came to me in a dream last night and he said, I want you to say Kaddish to me. about 15, but Dad, you never taught me anything about Salutary Reform Jew. You never taught me, and I never practiced anything. I haven't got a clue. Where'd you go for a minion? So my father said, don't worry, I'll bring the minion to you. You hear that? The most prestigious minion in America. He brought him to say Teddy. You see? So I did for this time, and he thought they were on their way to help him out in Baltimore. No, they weren't on their way to help him. They were on their way to help him out. Say, Caddy, you have to know these things. You have to feel them. You have to make a list of these things that happen to you so you can actually feel them. There were great Mashiach when we used to say that you have to write the Megillah of your life. You see, your life is a hidden story of yourself. Things happen in your life, everything happens for a reason, but you don't see it at the time. Sometimes even remarkable things happen at the time, you don't quite see them. But if you write them down and you see, so you learn this from the Megillah, the Megillah Purim is a story of hidden Hashem. There you don't see Hashem's name at all. There you see the events seem to be political, sort of mechanical, natural events. But when you take them together and you read the Megillah, you can't miss it. So the technique of Jewish TV, you have to write the Megillah of your life. You take each incident as an isolated incident, so you'll get an illuminum. But if you take the Mas'ayim, the Mas'ayim, if you write down the travel that took you to a certain place, and then you see what happened there, you'll see it definitely that had to happen in order to get here. It might have seemed like a tragedy at the time. Might have seemed negative, might have seemed confusing. But as you write them down and you see where you ended up, it's a remarkable thing. You know, in one's own life, I mean, we know each other, our friends knew that some of the things that I personally experienced, I've shared with you. I remember once in Southbound, the veteran David. Once in Southbound, I was up one night late, about 3 in the morning. I was writing something. I'm going to write a book. About 3 in the morning, 3:30 in the morning, there was a terrified phone call from my neighbor that his wife was in the pocket. There wasn't time to go any place. So I wrote those, and I was there within only 2 seconds to catch the baby. And I was there, I was dressed. I didn't have to wake up, I didn't have to get dressed, nothing. I was up. I raced across his apartment and I had to deliver the baby. So, at the first he made a speech about me. How lucky we are in Telstar, goes up to Sabuki, who up learning through the night. But so I tried to tell him, I said, I wasn't up learning through the night, and I saw mothers. So that's okay. I was up, you know, I was there, I was available, they were terrified. I was with my brother-in-law, who's the doctor of Telstar, wasn't around at the time. I happened to be there, I happened to be up. And I happened to be there, I was able to help. It wasn't that difficult because the ambulance crew was there by then. They gave me all sorts of Israeli advice about exactly how to do it. And what happened 2 years later, when I wasn't there, the lady who helped me deliver this baby, one of the other neighbors, a very, very organized type, who had never been caught in that sort of situation, had everything ready, hot water and towels, and all in 2 minutes everything was ready. Seems like she gave birth in her apartment. She was on the way down the stairs, she gave birth in that neighbor's apartment on the way down, and that neighbor was running around saying, if I'd known, I'd have cleaned up. You're not a bit off the subject, I just. But that was her Ashkofer, the teacher, what she needed. You also have to not only point out these things to yourself and to your children, but you have to make them alive as well. Somehow, the attitude, the atmosphere, the attitude that you give over in terms of the Emunah, the children pick up that sometimes even more explicitly than the actual events themselves. You know, there are many people on Pesach night. Pesach Seder is one of the great explosions of Emunah education that a child receives. Because on that occasion, you sit down explicitly for a lengthy period of time, and you gear your whole Seder towards the child to try and make him feel the experience of Jewish history and the upliftment of Jewish experience. There are many people who do it. You should definitely do it. Those of you who have a Jewish youth movement background, so you'll be experts at it. To do what we call living tochnit. Those of you who ever were in a youth movement here will know what I mean. You make it alive for the child, not just tell the child. There are many people who put the matzah in a set, in a pillowcase, and hang it over their shoulder, and they walk around the table like a slave carrying the matzah. They actually walk around the child. Never forget that. For you, it may seem a little sort of bit of pantomime, it may seem quaint, but the child will never ever forget that. You have to give it over with an enthusiasm, with a commitment, with a living example. In Tanakh, there's a place where it says that when Gideon was faced with an angel, with a malach, it says that one day Gideon was faced with an angel, with a malach. And a remarkable exchange takes place between them. When Gideon sees this angel of Hashem, a malach Hashem, he says to him, where are your signs and wonders? That's how he addresses this angel. He says to him, where are your signs and wonders? And of course, you said that that's remarkable. You don't speak that right, sir, Mother. When you see a mother, we're not talking here about seeing a fat child without clothes and wings flapping on his back. We're not talking about that. We're talking about an experience of the highest potency. We're talking about experience that's the difficulty, the impossible to describe, the completely transmuting experience. At that moment, people are unable to stand in their senses. And Gideon stands up to an angel and challenges him. He says, "Where are your signs and wonders?" You know what the Mephoshim say? Remarkable thing for the first day of Pesach. The night before, he had sat at the Seder table, and his father had told him about the signs and wonders of Hashem's appearance. It was so blazingly clear in his consciousness that when he saw Moloch, he wanted to see that immediately. That means the connection was so intrinsic for him. You have to do it that way. You have to give it over in that enthusiastic way, in that alive way that a child can feel it unerringly. One of the major issues that always comes up in this discussion is how do you maintain emunah in the face of tragedy, Leila? When things happen that are not good, something happens in the family, things happen that are not good, how do you then put across, what are you going to say then in that situation? We know that Shlomo HaMelech davened to Hashem that when a non-Jew davened, Hashem should always answer. If a non-Jew davened to the Beis HaMikdash, Hashem should always answer. But we know that Jews still is not like that. We have a deeper understanding. We know that we dive into Hashem in a conditional sort of fashion. That we want him to do things for us, but if they're not good, we accept that he shouldn't. That means that, you know, that we have to know that we don't lose emunah when things seem to be negative. On the contrary, of course we don't. If it wouldn't be for that, there'd be no nifayin in it at all. It wouldn't be a forgiving one if it wasn't like that. And that has to be given across to children. And that's not an easy thing to do. But the good news, the positive side of this, is that children are very resilient in this area. Children are often less likely to lose their money than you are. I remember my Rebbe once telling me, he lost a daughter who was 15. She was very sick and it took a long time, and finally the family lost her. A few days before she was missed, she said to him, must have been a remarkable girl, I mean she was in a tense pain, never complained ever, but a few days before when she felt it was imminent, she took her father aside and she said to him, "Abba, I want you to know that I know I'm going to a place that's better than you." And at that moment, she was trying to comfort him with her level of emunah. We're talking about a God of Israel here. He said it had nothing to do with him and his education, it was her. But I can assure you that the values in the family. The wife told me a story about a doll, a child who had a doll that was broken. Child's doll was broken, little girl's doll broke. So the mother said, and I couldn't fix the doll. So the mother said to the child, "Was ask Hashem." He said, "Listen in emunah. We can't fix this doll. You must go into Hashem. Ask Hashem. He knows how to do these things. Ask Hashem to fix the doll." The mother was worried because she thought the doll wasn't going to get fixed. So what happened was the doll did not get fixed. So the mother tentatively asked the child, "You know, did you go in?" The child said, "Yes." He said, "No." You see, the child, it might be a challenge to your level of emunah, but the child, not necessarily so. The child is open enough to be able to understand things or relate to things without some of the obstructions of rationality that we sometimes have. And therefore, if you put it across effectively to your child, and you not block or giving over a hesitant a vibe with the message, because the results don't seem to look the way you want, the child should know. The child should know. Sometimes the answer is no. That doesn't break our level of communication. Child knows that sometimes the parent says no, but it's only out of love. Sometimes the parent punishes, but it's not because of any breakdown between them. It's out of love that the parent is concerned and does these negative things. And it's in that light that a child should see the communication with Hashem. That finally, and there's many other things to say, but let's leave some time for discussion in case you have anything on your mind. Just the way in which you do it as a Jewish woman is so important. It isn't only knowing the right move, it's the atmosphere that you give over in terms of this whole area. If it's a rainy day, and a child's looking out the window, and the mother comes over and says, "What a terrible shame it is that it's raining. Now we can't go to the zoo." You're giving the child a negative approach. That child's always going to be miserable when it rains. But if you walk over to a child and you say, "What a bracha we were feeling, look at the rain. Say, look how the raindrops are racing down the window pane. Look how Hashem's helping things grow," and you give a tremendously positive vibe, the child will see rain as a bracha. The atmosphere that you give over, the way you handle adversity, the way you show self-control, the way you permeate your feelings, your strength, your resort to healing, your inner strength at a time when maybe other people are not feeling so strong, the smile that you manage to generate at a difficult time when the child's critically looking at you, those are the things that are important. And you can't allow things to creep in. You have to do it even at times when you think the child, you know, sometimes the three-year-old's crawling around under the table, and you're not subconscious of the child's existence. You should know that the child over there is listening intently to what's happening. And a small comment that you make to your husband at a time when a three-year-old's crawling around, you can destroy them in such a moment. There are children, psychologists will tell you that children will increase anxiety because they were crawling around under the table and the parents were discussing how they were going to make up the rent that night. That the three-year-old sees himself out on the street. He understands technical discussion. He sees that the family's going to be sitting on the outside, on the pavement, on the sidewalk. How are you going to... It means that you have to be strong in the mother, even when you're not speaking directly to the child, even when it might just be overheard, even when it's actions that you think you can take a chance with. You can't afford to do that. First of all, you need it for your own personal chinuch, and you need it for the growth of the child. Often the best way to handle difficult situations is to be quite straightforward with the child. To say that the person unfortunately was missed, or let's say they are now in a better place than this, they were ashamed. Explain exactly. The open, often the most direct and open explanation is the one that will work for the child the best. If you're at a level where the child is really absorbing it, then my reading daughter was missed, his four-year-old brother was taken to the Levaya. That's a remarkable thing. I'm not sure you should do that always. Four-year-old little boy was taken to pull in the heaven. But if it's an unusual level where the father knew as a great man that this was a positive experience, that this wouldn't be a soul-destroying experience for the child to do. I'm not again suggesting that this should always be done. That's another level. But if you can generate a level that's higher in these things, then the child can absorb more, and they can handle more, and they can self-generate more. Okay. Any questions or comments that you'd like to make, I'm very happy to. I personally feel, I think maybe there are some to tell us more about it, I personally feel from my experience that the rules that we spoke about apply, there's no question about it, and one doesn't lose strength because there's more of a challenge from the child. Right? Even if you feel it may not be registered now, but it will be registered later. But I think one has to be sensitive to the fact that if there is a rebellious sort of kind of attitude coming across or some sort of negativity, I think that has to be in context in general. I don't think it's only a mother that has to be certain. The child needs to know how much rope you can give them. The child needs to be a little bit, to expand, to flex their wings, muscles to some extent maybe. That isn't necessarily a threat to the overall structure of their development. I think with a mature understanding of that issue in general, I think emunah will fit into place. Yes, it is more difficult, and you may yet get challenges from the child explicitly, and I think it just can handle that in the way you describe. If the child is intellectually mature enough, then they can start learning up to trivia. They can start learning the different approaches to emunah. If they're interested, they can start learning the rational approach. There's a Kuzari and Ramban, and then there's a Rishonim, who go into Chatira, who go into, you know, intellectual looking at the arguments from the Zion and these things, which are first principles really in the sugya of emunah. A child can be walked through those sugyas at the level that they're able to experience it. Sometimes the child at that level still needs a more emotional approach. Chaskel Levenstein, there's a book by some Jewish women, daughters of great men of the last generation, where they write about their, an art school book, I forget the name of the book, where they write about the experiences with their fathers. And Edith Ginsberg writes that when she was in her father's house, when she was at that age, the way her father dealt with it was as follows. Remarkable story, worth knowing. What happened was, there were no schools that were suitable, that were sort of more Jewishly, I guess, ideal, and they were sent to a non-Jewish school. And once he took it very seriously, and he demanded that the girls study, she and her sister, they studied the curriculum, the syllabus of the school properly. They were secular subjects, and he demanded that they do them properly. On one parent's teacher's evening, he went in to see the teacher, of a good parent should, and the teacher, the headmistress of the school, told him that this particular girl, is a brilliant girl, and she should definitely go to university, and she's going to be a great professor in the academic world, and she could contribute to the culture of the country. So he immediately took her out of the school, and he made a school at home. Put the two girls at home in a room, and he gave them the curriculum, he taught them himself, he taught them geography, he taught them secular subjects the way it usually be taught them. And she relates one amazing thing, that one of the things that he insisted on in the curriculum that he privately taught them, was every single day they had to write an essay on the Ashgachat process that they'd had experience in the past 24 hours. You hear that? As part of their curriculum, each of these girls had to write in a little essay, a little paragraph, whatever, on an incident, at least one incident, of what they personally had experienced of Hashem's interaction with their lives in the past day. In educational experience, that is. Do you know how much you could miss and not realize that Hashem is doing for you unless you actually sit down and have to figure every single day they had to do that? That's a remarkable thing. You have a father like that. And you go through that sort of exercise and you train to seek it out and to write that material of your life, you'll see it. That's a bad idea, you have to make things dramatic. I know they say that the Mirror Mashgiach, some people in Mirror will tell you that once they were once It's well known the Chofetz Chaim. These people used to make things from that. The Chofetz Chaim, they say, when he was older, he used to learn simple pshat. He used to sit and learn pshat in Chumash, almost in a childlike way. He's taking on himself the childlike level of reality of what makes events real life. They said in the Mirna Shiach one day, somebody walked into the yeshiva and he used to have a room that overlooked the Beis Medrash. His room was high on the second floor overlooking the Beis Medrash. The Talmud says that he was out. I heard this from my Rosh Kollel. I'm not sure if he was present at the time, but there's a well-known story in this. That they were in a Beis Medrash and they heard the most enormous noise, unbelievable calamity occurring in the Mashiach's room. Unbelievable earth-shaking noise. So they ran up to see what had happened. What did they see? It's an unbelievable thing. The Mashiach had tiled standards. He had tiled standards on the yeshiva in two enormous walls. Yes, two walls of standards that he piled up, tons of wood, right? And they collapsed. Fortunately, he was okay, wasn't it? What was he doing? Because he was trying to imagine what Kriyas Yam Suf was like. He was trying to imagine what it was like to walk between the water. Can you imagine what he done? He collected standards up to the ceiling, piled them up to the ceiling, and was walking through it when they collapsed on it, you know? Can you imagine? You have a thought like that. I mean, your children might doubt your sanity at times, you have to be careful of it. But if you show that you make it dramatic, that you live the figure, it's not just something that you pay lip service to, I'm sure that would impress even. And if the teenager is insensitive at that time, because of peer pressure and so forth and so on, I'm sure that the message will. I personally, perhaps you don't have to comment about that, I personally don't think that there's anything wrong with that, as long as you don't give such a negative vibe that the child feels in fear all the time. Yes? Because that's not good education. You should try to emphasize the uplifting and positive aspects. But I personally don't feel there's anything wrong with telling it like it is also. That means there is an aspect of fear, and that as you can't deny that, the child has to know that. You're making pathologically afraid and you can see it having a negative effect on the child and then becoming terrified and neurotic and obsessive and so forth, that's not healthy. And I think it has to be adjusted to the needs of the child. There's certainly nothing wrong with telling the child, just like I'll punish you if you do something wrong, that there is a Hashgacha that watches you, that is appropriate. I don't think that the child is a normal child and able to handle a balance. I personally don't think that there's anything wrong with that. You must also realize you're dealing with a child's bubbling confidence to be able to handle situations. Yes, how realistically will they look at it? I was once walking down the path in Telstone and a 3-year-old child was plucking flowers on Shabbos. Yes? So the mother came up to the child and said, Chayel, it's Shabbos, you can't pick flowers. And the child, 3-year-old, looked up and said, Baruch Hamavdeh. They're not so easily pronounced by yours, you know, they're not an animal. That's the tough one. That's a tough one and one to be expected, yes? At least you can be prepared for that, because that should be expected. I'm not sure that's what's going to set up a negative relationship between you and the future. But I think that, again, I don't see any other way to handle it than straightforward, honest and open. You have to tell the child that it's a fact that you don't see it openly. You don't see the transcendental openly. To the level that he's able to absorb, why not? You can try and explain that. But if he's not able to absorb that, you have to state the fact. You have to take the fact that Hashem wants us to become close to Him without making it easy. He's able to absorb that fact, that He wants work from us, yes? That He wants us to, if He's old enough to be given a marshal, that you would expect Him to love you and relate to you intensely even if you didn't happen to be in the room or even if you happened to go away for a while. Yes, that you would expect Him not to forget about it. We did meet Hashem once, is in our consciousness. We did it openly and explicitly at Sinai, and that's burned in our blood since then. And we would expect those credentials of that relationship to stand till now. Hashem trusts us to have the loyalty, and we don't just forget about Him because we haven't dealt intimately since then, you know. For that you need to also generate the consciousness that we're one people as an organic entity. Because he will come back to you and say, well, that was my great-great-great-grandfather. For that he needs to feel that the Jewish people are an organic entity where we share their experience. And that needs to be worked on. Either Sisho has another whole subject about how he has to relate intimately and intrinsically to each of the people. That has to be done too. A third element that has to be done is that, you see, there's two issues here. One is the specific answer to the question that the child's asking. It's very doubtful that you find, you know, a wiped-out answer that absolutely will show it. You won't do this, right? What you're trying to teach him is to handle the difficulty of the experience of the darkness, yes? What we're trying to handle in these 3 weeks, really, the time of thinking about how far Hashem is at this time, and make it closer, that's what really the child needs to be thinking. He can't be given everything that he wants to show everything that he wants anyway. If he's able to come to terms openly with that, you keep asking, you have to keep explaining that our job is to function in this and this way. But I can't avoid, and it would be irresponsible not to mention to you, that's not the only, again, that's one element of the issue. How are you going to handle that conversation specifically? And you can check with people who know more than I do also. But for sure what you have to be careful about is that the environment that the child's growing up in, all the other underpinnings of this issue are being laid down carefully. If the child is being taught all the elements that he needs to put this picture together correctly, then you have a chance. But if you try to give them the correct answer here, and you're not living up to the things yourself, and all the others, for example, there are many authorities in education who say, I'll just give you an example, there must be many, that as a child, 5-year-old child, starts to learn basic chumash, for example. So immediately, as he starts to learn the basics, he must be taught Medrash and Chazal as well. You see, there are many people where there's been a movement away from formal official Yiddishkeit, where there's a certain sort of atmosphere, attitude, that what it says in chumash is 100% true and we don't doubt that. What it says in a rabbinic tradition is sort of human opinion. And the child grows up with a sort of dichotomy. You follow, there are many restrictions, many philosophers now of adult age who will tell you that Bible, yes, they have a definite faith, and there's no question about it, that they accept. But the rabbinic opinion, what it says is a Talmud, you know, they were brought up to think, they have a human opinion. Well, if you have Bible without the human opinion, without Tarish of Al-Termas, you don't have anything. On the contrary, you're worse than them. So if you bring up a child, you see, by telling him, by reading him the explicit Bible stories, and not telling him the depth of what it means, so you'll bring up a child who, when he seeks for the deeper answers, when he tries to find them, he doubts the source that he's going to get those answers from. So when he comes up with something improbable, or something problematic, yes, in that the written tradition doesn't satisfy, or that doesn't answer his question, or a problem, and he doesn't have recourse to a depth of a wealth of information that makes that real, then there's almost no way to speak to him. You see, the child should grasp knowing that when it says Moshe Rabbeinu walked up the mountain, it means a man walked up the mountain. But every bit as clearly, when it says the tears of the Malachim fell as the Yitzchak's eyes, that every bit is clear, that's not subject to doubt, that's sorry just as much. So that when, so, because, where am I heading? And I'll finish with this. If you read in Chumash, for example, you won't find anything about the world to come. You won't find. In Torah, explicitly, doesn't say anything about a world after this. The child's going to ask you, what about transformation and what about the world to come? Well, if you're addicted to reading in Bible stories, you see, you won't find it anywhere in Chumash. And you're going to bring up a child who's going to doubt that concept if you've given him that dichotomy. But if you've brought him up with every possible, giving the Rashi on it, giving Chazal on that topic, and many of them are wonderful at childhood level, many of Rashi are ideally suited at their simple level to a child's consciousness, so then the child will grow up to one doubt. When you read through Bible one day and somebody asks him, well, it doesn't say any place over here, and you start giving him drushes that sound very shaky if you're not steeped in the tradition of the Torah Shabbat there, you see, then, so what you have to do is you have to explain to the child, and there's such beautiful ways to approach it, like Aaron Kotler used to say, that the reason that the next world is hidden in the reason that the next world is hidden in the Torah is because it's hidden in this world, and Torah is an exact reflection, isn't that beautiful? Torah is an exact description of this world. If you can't see it here, then the Torah can't state it explicitly because the one is to parallel the other exactly. A child who's been brought up with a feel for Torah Shabbat will assimilate that idea beautifully. So I think that in summary the answer is to be able to face the question squarely, say what we can know and what we can't know, we don't know everything, handle it as often as you can. But make sure that you're giving him the wherewithal that as he becomes more mature, he has the ability to become steeped in Jewish tradition at a level that takes a more sensitive understanding than simple perfecting of words.